Welcome to the Empowering Agency Workers, the podcast for all temporary workers. If you're unsure of your rights, unsure how to find work, or just plain unsure, we're here to help. It's all too easy to be exploited, so your expert host, Julia Kermode, will empower you to succeed.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm really delighted to be joined by Tim Jacob, and we're going to talk about understanding how recruitment agencies work, which is really important for our listeners who are obviously agency workers, candidates putting themselves forward for jobs. So welcome, Tim. Thanks for joining me.
Hello, thanks for having me, Julia. Thanks for having me.
No, you're welcome. So I'm pleased to have you with us because I've just got a bit of background here about you. So you began your career in technology recruitment with computer people in, 1995, which seems like a really long time ago.
Yes.
Perhaps I shouldn't have mentioned the year.
It was a long time ago.
Last century, if that makes you feel any better.
We had to fax CVs. We had filing cabinets with CVs in. Timesheets being run around. It was all.
You were also on the board of REC, which is the Recruitment Employment Confederation.
Well done,
yes,
Julia.
And they are the largest professional body for recruitment professionals.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yes, I sat on the board of that. It was a very, very interesting time. So, yes, representing the recruitment industry to government, particularly, and also representing its members to government, and also looking at the way and assisting the way in which the recruitment industry operated across all sectors. Across all types of recruitment, and that's where we came across each other.
So that was
a real eye opener for me to really get to know a lot more about the industry as a whole. Led me about 18 months ago to I now work for a business called Squadrato, which advises recruitment businesses on growth. And also about maturing their businesses, so offering their clients different types of recruitment and talent solutions to aid their development and growth, basically, as a business. So that's what I'm doing at the moment.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like a huge amount of fun, and you're obviously putting all of your experience to good use to help others, which is fantastic and well needed at this time, I imagine.
Yes, it's been a strange time. Recruitment's really is an industry that's a bellwether for the wider economy, both on the way down, and I've been through a few downs, this being a big one of them, but on the way up as well.
Yes, exactly. Well, I'm a big fan of the contingent workforce, and I think it is one of the ways that has helped the UK in different economic times. But anyway, let's get down to business, because what we want to do is talk about how agencies work. And now, obviously, you've got huge amounts of experience from when you worked for an agency, and now you're an advisor to agencies. Why do you think it's important for candidates to understand the agency's perspective?
I think it's useful for candidates from the perspective of just having the right sort of expectations from the agency that they're dealing with. And I think one of the challenges is that the recruitment agency is obviously much maligned. But I think if candidates can get an insight into the motivations, the point of view of a recruitment agency, then they might better understand some of the behaviours and be able to, in the nicest possible way, exploit and be in the right position to be able to take advantage of what recruiters do.
The other thing, when you were just saying about recruitment and the recruitment profession and how it's a bit maligned or much maligned, if you Google it, which I haven't done for ages, but if you do Google recruitment, it is pretty horrific, isn't it, sometimes, some of the stuff you get back?
The reason for that is it's a very emotive topic. It's an emotive part of people's lives, their work. how much they get paid. It's such an intrinsically important part of people's everyday life that a recruiter or recruitment agent is obviously disturbing, interfering, prying into that part of somebody's life, and often at a stressful time when someone's looking for a job, or start wanting to have a conversation on the other end about tempting people away. And you can view that in a, depending on your personal morals, I suppose, you can view that as quite a mercenary activity. But unfortunately, it is a commodity. But people are a commodity, and it's commoditizing that, which does great. And frankly, when I entered the recruitment industry, grated with me quite a lot as well, but I came to terms with it over time.
Recruitment is a bit like estate agents or something in terms of one of the much maligned professions. And I don't understand why, because the recruitment process is massive. And obviously, recruitment consultants and recruitment agencies are kind of working to their clients, I suppose, more than the candidates. And that might be a reason for some of the poor perceptions out there. I mean, you know, from your experience, why is the client so important for recruitment?
Well, I think that, you know, the role of a recruiter is the classic arbitrage in any kind of commercial transaction, but they're slightly unique in that they have got two customers. They've got the candidate and they've got the client. And as you go through the recruitment cycle, the dynamics of that change. But in general, although candidates are important, and in some sectors they're very, very important, particularly in highly skilled, hard-to-fill, what we'd refer to as hard-to-fill type sectors, technology, engineering, etc. But in general, the client's importance tends to be greater to a recruiter. And there's a pretty simple reason for that, is because they're paying generally. And so the recruiter is going to be motivated much more by the client's behavior than anything else. And this is going to sound, this is possibly quite controversial. Some of the behaviors, or a lot of the behaviors that candidates experience, are actually mirroring the client, the client and mirroring what's happening in the client or in the client recruitment process. And I think, so for example, I mean, I've read something today, I think on the BBC website, about somebody who's applied for tens, hundreds of jobs in the last 6 months, maligning the fact that they never got a response.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
A lot of that will because there's a volume issue in being able to respond to every candidate, but also some of that is because the client that actually doesn't have a response or hasn't got a robust process for giving candidate feedback. I've run a recruitment desk as well, and often you don't get a response from a client at all, or you get no response. Response that you can easily pass on, shall we say.
Wow, I never knew that, honestly. Yeah. So perhaps the problem is clients then, not recruitment firms.
I think the problem is not clients. The problem is perhaps their process isn't as robust as it could be.
I wasn't trying to lead you to slag off all clients. I apologise for that.
it's the clients need a better recruitment process. I think, so to give you an example, I tend to talk to recruitment businesses who are dealing in white collar knowledge based sectors. So I'll caveat what I'm about to say it kind of applies to that. I'm not somebody from what would be known as high volume recruitment background. The recruiters what we'd refer to as a transactional agency, a contingent agency, who are hunting for jobs, finding jobs, then looking to send candidates for those jobs in a competitive environment. They're they will only fill, if they're filling 20% of the vacancies they take, they'd be very happy.
Right. Okay.
Wow. Very happy. And that's even at the moment.
Gosh.
20% fill rate of all the vacancies in a recruitment agency getting filled in that sector is considered to be, you're doing well if you're getting to that.
Yeah, that's much lower than I would have expected, actually. So how on earth can they be doing that? I mean, I know from having worked in this sector for a number of years that the role of recruitment is quite a bit broader than most people would necessarily think. So how can these recruiters be surviving then on kind of that 20% rule when I know how much more they have to do?
Well, some of that is taken into account from their fees. Some of that is taken into account by their behaviours of wanting to secure the relationship with their client and the process with the client when they take on a role. So recruiters will be trying to get candidates to commit to using them exclusively. Recruitment will be trying to get clients to they'll be looking to get clients to use them exclusively for a role, or we're looking for the client to commit at the point of them giving a role, making sure the role is a real role, that they have got realistic expectations about filling the role, that they have got realistic expectations from a salary perspective, skills perspective, background perspective, and that they'll try and commit the client to timelines for interviews, feedback, those sorts of things to offset this challenge in transactional recruitment of being at arm's length a bit and not being able to working so many roles that don't go anywhere. So there's a big focus on job board equality or vacancy quality and relationship quality that they have with the client as well. And they're always trying to work to secure that partnership agreement with the client so that they are working roles that are very fillable.
So is it the case then that sometimes a recruitment consultant might be talking to a client about a role that then turns out to not really exist? Are the clients sometimes just sounding out the market?
That's commonly done. The clients will also sound out the market if they think they've got a flight risk. So
I see.
You know, it depends on the sector, and I'll caveat again, I'm talking more in the kind of white collar, my experiences in the white collar professional services side of things. So they've got flight risk. Often some of the demand will be dependent on them winning some business. So they want to be prepared. So they'll be looking into the market to see what candidates are available, the cost of candidates, how easily it might be to source those candidates. It can also be that, and this often happens, is that the person that the recruiter is dealing with has a desire to hire someone, but the finance director gets wind of it and goes, no, you're just going to have to do more with what you've got. There might be problems, and all of those things can change from the point at which you instruct a recruiter to the point at which you want to hire somebody, or circumstances might change within the business as during that process as well. The recruitment life cycle, so from the point of taking a vacancy to somebody starting walking through the door for a permanent role is, you know, a minimum of 4 to 6 weeks, and sometimes it takes longer, and there can be lots of kind of bumps and things along the way.
And this is really interesting, actually, because what you're saying is that the recruitment firms invest quite a bit of time, maybe at the early stages even, before they even know if the role is real. And of course, no money is exchanged at that point, I guess, or am I?
It's not normally the case. I think what recruiters are trying to do is at the front end is trying to assess as best they can the validity or likelihood that this role is needing to be filled. And so what I do with the recruitment businesses is look to help them secure their and mature their relationships with clients so that they're in a better position to to have clarity and confidence that that role needs to be filled. In terms of charging, etc., you know, if I, you know, depends which sector you talk to. If you're a headhunter in the city, it's just recruitment. Mm. But if you're a headhunter in the city doing executive search for CEOs, it's just recruitment. Then for some reason, you can convince a client to pay you a third up front for taking the vacancy, a third on shortlist, and a third when they hire a person. Quite the reason they can do that is, you know.
Because of who we are. We're so exclusive.
Yeah. But all recruiters will be familiar with trying to get a client to commit to retained work, to retain them to find candidates, etc. So but obviously if you are in a scenario where a client's retained you to do some work, then obviously your motivation as a recruiter is going to be a lot higher, your focus is going to be a lot higher, your diligence is going to be a lot higher on making sure that you make the perfect hire for the client. I think this points to the fact that, you know, there are different types of recruiters who operate with clients in a different way. At one end you have a ones and twosy type arrangement where, you know, which is definitely how I started in recruitment, where you're looking to pick, you're calling clients, looking to find jobs or marketing really good candidates to clients who use those sorts of candidates. Mm. And as you mature through that, you get clients who then appoint a preferred supplier list of agencies to work on their vacancy. But then you move into the world of recruitment process outsourcing, managed service provision, talent solutions, where clients will outsource all of their recruitment operation or part of their recruitment process to a recruiter. Yeah. So some of your listeners will be familiar with someone like James Kahn, who is a very famous recruitment entrepreneur. He set up a business called Alexander Mann Solutions. That is one of the globe's largest recruitment process outsourcing businesses on the globe. Mm-hmm. And the UK, the UK is a leader in the recruitment industry. The top four of the top 10 recruiters globally are UK based. Michael Page, Hayes, many UK recruiters have been bought by large corporates. The Randstads of this world, Adecco, the business I first started with, Computer People, is now part of the Adecco group. So those businesses, you know, operate recruitment process outsourcing, and it's increasingly a model that clients will use, where they will, particularly if they're in a specialist space, where they will want to use the recruiter to own parts of the whole recruitment process. So from the point of demand all the way through to fulfillment, not just the bit of filling a job, but managing the whole process all the way through, from demand management with the client, setting up selection and process management, what is a good recruitment process with the right feedback loops, using technology to automate it. If your listeners are applying to a large FTSE 100 company in the UK at the moment, it's likely that they're going to be interacting, unbeknownst to them, with a recruitment process outsourcer who may be badged as the end client in the city. You know, Robert Walters and Resource Solutions are a good example of that as well. They operate recruitment process outsourcing. So recruiters at one end of the market are also in the world of being outsourcers and consultants in recruitment. Yeah.
And I guess the advantage of that is for the client is that they've then got kind of a partnership approach. And I guess the advantage for those doing the whole recruitment process is that they get to really understand what those clients' needs are, and then they're better able to fulfill them, I'm imagining.
There's a governance and process element to it. You know, it's done in a fast, efficient way. It can be measured clearly about what success is. It's controlled both from a cost perspective and also from a demand and perspective. You'd be surprised how many clients that this conversation happens with, that they feel that recruitment's the hardest thing they do, the hardest thing to get right. Yeah. the hardest. The thing that fills them with dread is hiring somebody.
I've always loved it. I've loved whenever I've recruited staff, but I guess I'm just quite nosy. I like to see who's out there and see what they're up to. But the actual process itself in terms of dealing with the applications and that sort of thing, no, not interested in. But give me the interview, meeting people, fun.
There you go. But the process bit, sifting through candidates, making sure you give great what's become known as the candidate experience.
Yeah.
Making sure the hiring manager experience is great. Making sure, particularly if you're of a certain size or scale, you know, you start to talk about the employer value proposition, what the brand, the employer brand is in the market. So for example, this is an example I can talk about. Google.
Mm-hmm.
Google, when Google set up Google Maps in the UK, this is a true thing. They spent 2.5 years mapping and tracking the best digital cartographers from the Ordnance Survey.
Right.
And talking to them every month.
Okay.
How are you going? How's it going? what's on your mind? Have you seen that what we're doing over at Google? They mapped the whole of the talent pool of people. They knew who they were going to hire a year, 6 months before they set up.
Gosh.
So they would have exactly the right type of candidate available to them, and they knew what they needed to do to set up that stuff. So it means you're not going to get you've got the right people, you know you've got them interested, you know you've communicated the right brand to them, you know that all of those things make it interesting. So your listeners might not be aware of this, but did you know, Julia, that if you pay enough, you can see everybody and everything on LinkedIn?
I didn't, although I'm very nosy. I haven't got to that stage of boredom yet. But
recruitment companies and then clients, but mainly recruitment companies, spend a lot of money with LinkedIn to get access to all of LinkedIn, to get into, be able to map talent within LinkedIn. And LinkedIn have a product called Talent Finder, where a client can look and say, who's left in the last 12 months and which companies have they gone to?
Right.
Who's joined us in the last 12 months and which companies have they come from?
Mm.
Where do they live? What are the job roles? Dig down into all of that data and see map their talent pool, map where their talent is coming from, map where their talent is going to. So all of a sudden, you know, you're starting to open up some of, so I'm just giving you a window into some of the things that people will do to identify the right talent in the right way. And some of the data that's now being used to kind of track people, and, you know, you may suddenly get invites or emails in your LinkedIn profile going, I've never spoken to this person before. How come they've emailed me? That job ad looks exactly like the sort of thing I might be interested in.
Funnily enough.
And that's true on Facebook. That's true on other social media platforms. A large part of those is a large part of that data is used by recruiters. I started in 1995, the largest part of the Sunday Times newspaper was the appointment section, wasn't it?
Not
anymore. It was their most income they got was from the appointment section. Not anymore. It's now a lot of this is done and tracked digitally. Yeah. So increasingly you see a segmentation in what recruitment agencies are doing and also the roles of recruiters. This is very prevalent in the US and in some other markets, but you'll tend to find individuals at recruitment companies will be specialists in candidate sourcing or handling the candidate side of things. And you then get individuals who are more focused on handling the client's expectations and ensuring that the process is working in the right way. But it very much depends. There's a whole kind of spectrum of recruitment companies out there, but they range in sophistication all the way through that.
This is incredible. So, I mean, I'm literally blown away by our conversation because I just love this whole data stuff that's going on, all this stuff that we all have a digital fingerprint or whatever. I've probably used completely the wrong word, but we all have that. And I'm amazed that all this stuff is being used and collected about us and that there's all this kind of cleverness going on behind the scenes in the world of recruitment. I mean, it's almost slightly devious in a way, in terms of what LinkedIn, you know, might be doing with the information we put up.
You signed up to the privacy policy of LinkedIn.
yeah, and obviously we all read our terms and conditions very carefully. So, what do we expect? So, incredible stuff. So, does all of this mean then that kind of the candidates going for jobs are not really cared about? But then that's not true in the example of Google, because Google went to a lot of trouble of nurturing their
future workforce. And then I wanted to sort of slightly debunk what I was saying there. But I think in the balance, and as I said, as the recruitment process develops, that relationship from a recruiter's perspective, that relationship, the scales of that relationship change. But generally, you know, Google weren't going to hire the people unless they wanted to hire the people. Google were thinking about who the people that they wanted to hire were.
Yeah.
It wasn't the other way around. They were nurturing the candidates, not the other way around. I suppose it's just not a bad assumption for a candidate to understand that the client, for a recruiter anyway, the client is likely to have more of an influence, particularly at the early stages of a recruitment life cycle, than they are at the end. So, you often hear, you know, people get frustrated by, you know, much like the estate agency analysis analogy around price. You know, I got all the way through to the final interview, and then I spoke to the agent, and they offered me a ridiculously £5,000 below what I said my asking salary was. That's the client thing.
Because I guess, I mean, the salary expectations would have been talked about at the outset with the recruitment firm and the client, surely.
And you'd have to be, you know, and I'm not saying there aren't terrible recruiters out there, just as there are in every walk of life, but, you know, the recruiter's very interested in that, because typically they're going to get some sort of payment based on that salary, and they don't want to have a negotiation at the last minute.
That's true. And also, from the recruiter perspective, they don't want to put someone forward if there's no chance at all. Exactly. So it's a waste of their time, as much as anything. So
it's a waste of their time, unless they need to do their quota, and they'll just try anything to try and fill the job, just they've got no other jobs on, which can happen.
I have heard stories of exactly what you're saying, where a recruiter has done the whole process, put a candidate forward, and then the client has said, I want to offer them less, I just want to save money. So they offer them less, and they lose that candidate entirely. And it's a flawed approach by that client.
I was talking to a recruiter just this morning who deals, if it makes you feel any better, who deals with in the German market, and he was bemoaning the fact that he'd spent took a brief before Christmas for a very highly skilled individual in Germany, been through a very structured recruitment process with the client. 3 weeks ago, the client said they were definitely going to offer them the job, this person. They've been through 6 interviews, definitely going to offer them.
6 interviews.
Blind. 3 weeks later, they still have not issued an offer letter.
Oh my gosh.
Each time he speaks to them, they're going, we're definitely offering. That's the person we want.
Can't understand it, because they'll lose that candidate then. And if they're perfect for that role, then it's so flawed.
But I'm not trying to say that there isn't sharp practice in the recruitment industry. I know there is, you know, sitting on the board of the REC, you know, part of what the REC does is act as a kind of standards arbitrage for the recruitment industry, and deals with some complaints and works closely with the UK government around regulation in the recruitment business.
Yes.
There is sharp practice practice that goes on.
There is with any sector, and I think that's one of the reasons why I set up iWork was I felt that some people would be looking at temporary work and temporary assignments for the first time, potentially as a result of the pandemic. And I thought it was all too easy for them to be exploited by virtue of being with a recruitment firm who perhaps is less good than other recruitment firms.
In the contract and freelancer markets, there's, you know, the added complexity of quite increasingly, certainly in my career, that's what, in 1995, I started hiring freelance contract IT professionals. So my background I grew up doing that. And 25 years is a long time, but there's been a huge amount of legislation and change in that space in that time. Much of it focused on, you know, taxation legislation, employment legislation, you know, things like, not in the same market, but things like introduction of the game master licenses, the introduction of licensing, the more regulation around actually how recruiters are regulated, which they weren't for many, many years, but now are by law. Just last April, I'm sure we'll touch on this, IR35 and the reform to IR35 coming this April. But last April, there were four other statutory instruments that came in that affected the operation of recruitment businesses.
I did at one point look to count up the number of changes just in the time that I've been in the sector, which is about 7 years now. And it's a huge number, and I'm laughing. It's not even funny. I don't know how recruitment firms can really deal with it. And I think that's probably why some of this stuff is kind of outsourced. So even within the recruitment process, which is an outsourced function in the way that we're talking about it for clients, but even with that kind of payroll and other things does get outsourced on, I guess, to free up the recruitment professionals to do the rest of it. You know, it's a huge job.
And it's driven by clients as well. They want to outsource. They want to outsource and distance themselves from non-permanent workers' payroll. Very much so. I'll go back to what I said before. That's a client decision. They could do that themselves. They could do that themselves if they wanted to.
So coming back to kind of agency workers what kind of key things could they do to be a good candidate? So we've spoken a bit about the wide-ranging role for recruitment agencies. So what can candidates who are listening right now, perhaps applying for an everyday entry-level type of role because they need work at the end of the day, what can they do to help themselves? I guess there's probably about 200 applications for most jobs these days. I don't know that. How can they be a good candidate?
Well, I think as with any relationship, you want to nurture. I think being trying to put your frustrations to one side and the stress to one side. Keep to your commitments. If you do get through the process, you know, keep with the commitments. Try and show as much flexibility as possible in terms of going through the process. But when you say you're going to do something, you definitely do it. I think also being clear about you need to have an expectation that a lot of what you're going to be doing, particularly at the start of a recruitment process, is going to be automated. There's going to be a heavy use of technology in the process. So you need to think carefully about your written, any data that you put into the system, any, you know, your CV, any application forms that you put into the system, that you're putting in the right words in the right way in the right order so that the algorithm will pick you up as quickly as possible. There's no getting away from the fact that speed is going to be key. The other thing is, actually, I think it's something like quite a high percentage, I'm going to get this wrong, say 60 or 70% of jobs aren't found through recruiters.
Right.
Clients will advertise direct. You know, you should do what recruiters do. Use your networks. Talk to people you know. Talk to people who are in a job to see if there is another job. Recommendation is much the easiest way of working through a job. When I've been involved in managed service programs for contractors, for example, often somewhere between 10 to 25% of the contractors will be referrals, as in they're known to somebody already. They've been introduced directly to the business. And keep asking and keep going. It is a bit of a numbers game.
To a certain extent. What you're saying about kind of it. It's that phrase, isn't it? It's so often not what you know, but who you know. And it is so true, actually. Yeah. I do know a lot of businesses who rarely advertise for jobs. You see it on LinkedIn as well. Someone in my network, rather than doing a proper job advert, they've just sort of posted on LinkedIn that they're looking for people. Does anyone know anyone?
And you can... Yeah. You know, if you're in that professional services space, there's a lot you can do on LinkedIn outside of the product, outside of the job products and stuff, to search timelines, search, go through companies, go to companies' pages directly. I think, you know, the other thing is that, you know, play the technology. There is candidate technology out there that helps you play against the technology that's used in the recruitment process. We'll do automatic applications for you.
Right.
So we'll monitor job sites and job boards when jobs come up, and we'll automatically send in your sleep.
That's great. So I didn't know that.
There is tech out there that helps some of this fastest finger first stuff. Being open and frank and honest in the conversation, I think, goes a long way. And you do assume that the recruiter on the other end of the phone is fundamentally going to work in is going to operate in the same way. The vast majority of them do. And if they do something that, you know, seems a bit underhand or seems a bit flighty, it's often driven by something that's happening outside of your control by candidate behaviour. It's not always done, because, you know, a recruiter, it's likely that the recruiter, if you're talking to an agency transactional recruiter, they get paid commission. They get paid.
Yeah.
The more they sell, the more they get paid. And normally about anything between 20 to 40% of their income, sometimes more, is based on their sales, on how many fees they bring in every month. So they are highly motivated from that perspective, and they're highly motivated to get that. They want you to get a job. They'd rather convince a client to take you on than not. But ultimately, they are driven by what the client's decision is going to be.
So I suppose you have to remember that it's not actually in their interest to kind of mistreat you, the candidate, the applicant, and they're just trying to kind of match people as best as possible to the roles.
And as often as quickly as possible, so they can work on another role. Because they're expecting, remember that 20%, if they're doing well, they might feel 20% of the jobs that they have in there. On their desk, and that's if they're doing well. They want to cover off a job quickly and get onto the next job. And you know, I'm working with recruiters to make sure that the jobs they're working on are much better quality, working better with their clients, maturing the relationships with their clients. But it you know, often is not the case. It's often because there isn't a close relationship with the client. So it would be a good question for a candidate to kind of understand, you know, what the relationship is with the client when you're talking, if you manage to talk to a recruiter about the role. And, you know, understand from the, if you do get to that point, understand from the recruiter what their expectation of the process is likely to be, not based on what this job's going to look like, but when you worked on the last job, how did it go? What sort of things, how quickly did they come back? Is it one of the client that you've worked with before?
But so it's almost from the candidate's perspective about managing their own expectations, and you can't do that unless you get that information from the, recruitment.
Exactly. You can't do that unless you've got some, you can only go on what you've been told, but stick to what you say you're going to do, be trustworthy and open, and make sure that you exude commitment, that you're committed to going to this interview, you're committed to taking this job, that you'll commit, I've got three other interviews, I want to get a job. These three other interviews are at this time, this time, and this time. As long as they're not at that time, I'll do another interview or whatever it might be.
It's I guess it's all about good communication, as so often it is the case with lots of things.
Being open and stuff.
Never
tell a recruiter where you're interviewing. Never do
that. Because then the recruiter might then target them to sell their own recruitment services, perhaps.
It's called the domino cell in recruitment skill.
Right.
The domino cell. Just imagine you've just worked on a vacancy. You filled the vacancy. Julia, congratulations, you've got the job. Start in a month's time. Julia, how it's going? I'm really glad that you got the job. It's brilliant. By the way, where did you work before? What was it? Oh, yeah, who did you work for? Oh, I worked for Joe Blocks. Oh, right, okay. Boom. Hi, Joe. You know Julia, who just left? I placed her at your competitor. By the way, the shortlist I gave the competitor was really good. You must have a vacancy now, and I've got a ready-made shortlist.
But you see, from the candidate's perspective, if they're on that ready-made shortlist, then that can help them find that next role. So just depends how you look at it, really. I think that's a really good place to end, because it's really positive depending on your perspective. So massive thank you so much for your time today, because I know you're busy. And perhaps we can talk again in a few months, see how things are going.
Yes, good stuff. It's a really enjoyable chat, Julia.
Thank you for listening to Empowering Agency Workers, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.